I want us to remember what happened that day and be horrified by ourselves.
New York in the late 1980s was a completely schizophrenic, divided city.
New York's now the capital of racial violence.
If I had more bullets, I would have shot them all again and again.
Criminality, gang wars, drug wars. We were supposed to be afraid. It would have been irrational not to be afraid.
Off with the camera, man!
Welcome to Film Wax Radio, the independent film talk show. Every week, we're visited by filmmakers, actors, journalists, programmers, and others to sit down and chat about the state of independent film. On April 19th, 1989, Trisha Miley was brutally attacked and raped in Central Park. In the rush to placate an outraged public, five teenagers of color were arrested for what was then being referred to as the crime of the century. The Central Park jogger case was indisputably the biggest media story of its day. Filmmakers Ken Burns, daughter Sarah Burns, and her husband David McMahon have documented the case with a new film called Central Park 5. The film takes on the entire scope of the city's events, including those involved. Then, on September 12th, the filmmakers received a subpoena from the City of New York requesting access to the film's interviews and unreleased footage, but the filmmakers refused to comply, claiming that the city's request was neither appropriate nor enforceable under the governing law of subpoenas served on professional journalists exercising their right of independent free speech. Today's episode of Film Wax Radio is a little different. We're centering it on Central Park 5, which has again been directed by Sarah Burns, daughter of Ken Burns, David McMahon, her husband, and Ken Burns. The show is broken into three segments, the first with Sarah and David, the second with Kerry Wise, one of the Central Park 5, and lastly with filmmaker Ken Burns. Sarah Burns and David McMahon, thank you, first of all, for coming on to Film Wax Radio.
Thanks for having us.
That was Sarah, just so our listeners can distinguish. David has a much higher voice.
Thank you for having us.
Guys, I know we were talking before that you live in Brooklyn, but where were you living in 1989?
I was 6 years old and living in rural New Hampshire, where my dad still makes most of his films. And so I was completely unaware of the case at the time. I didn't learn anything about it at all until 2003.
And I was living in upstate New York. I was 12, all the way up in Buffalo. And I had no recollection of the case. In the late 80s, my sort of sense of New York City was that it was a place to be avoided at all costs, that it was a dangerous and dirty place. And when we would go as a family to visit friends on Long Island, we would travel all the way to Connecticut and take a ferry across to avoid the possibility of breaking down somewhere on the tangle of expressways or getting lost in New York where untold horrible things could happen.
And have a bonfire, the vanities moment or something.
Exactly. I actually first heard of the case in 1994 when my randomly assigned college roommate pointed across the quad at a guy who was a classmate of his in high school and said, "That is the brother of one of the five guys who gang raped the Central Park jogger in 1989. So even at that point, it was accepted fact that they were guilty of this crime. And so I then asked him to explain the case to me because I was too young in 89 to remember, but it had made that kind of impression on him. And it was, as I said, it was just accepted that they, of course, had done it.
You said you finally became aware of the case in 2003, which would have been shortly after they began their case, right? Their lawsuit against the City of New York.
They had served their complete sentences and been released before that. Corey, though, who'd served the longest sentence, had only just been released. And at that time in 2003, I was in college and spending the summer working as an intern for a pair of civil rights lawyers. And they were involved in that civil suit. And that was how I learned about the case. I met Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson that summer and got to know a little bit more about the story and became really fascinated by it.
And it also began a decade-long journey for you as well.
Yes, I was at the time in college, as I said, and majoring in American Studies and looking for a topic for my senior essay. And so this story really captured my attention and interest, and so I ended up writing my undergraduate thesis about it, and then a couple years later came back to it. I sort of couldn't let it go, and so I began at that point writing a book, which I spent the better part of 5 years on, researching and writing a book about the case. And then early on in that process, we decided that we also just had to make a film. It's such an important story and one that really lent itself well, I think, to the medium of documentary film.
I think I saw in an interview your dad, he sort of said for him it was a natural film because to participate in because it deals essentially with the themes that he's been dealing with, that of race in America.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is in many ways very similar to his other work in the sense that we're really dealing with the same issues that he's wrestled with in his films for decades. But at the same time, this is a different kind of story, and we had different resources for it. And so it's inevitably a very different film in a lot of ways also. I mean, we had our main characters here to tell their story on camera themselves in their own words. And so, you know, we did these interviews with the five, and they had such a great ability to remember and to explain what had happened to them. I think we'd always wanted to try to do this film without narration, but it became very clear to us once we interviewed them that we could do it, that they could carry the story and really tell it themselves. And so that's one pretty significant way that it differs from my dad's other work, and that we don't have a narrator.
I assume because of your work with the Civil Rights Office and their attorneys that you had gained already had a certain level of a default trust. Maybe you can just describe the process of how you get them and their involvement and make sure that everybody was going to be represented in a very fair way, and that it had to be tricky for them to revisit all this.
Yeah, I mean, with the five and their lawyers, really, who I had to talk to initially in order to get permission to talk to them for the book, the five were actually all really interested in participating from the beginning. It was some of the lawyers who weren't so sure that they wanted this project to happen, but they did come around. And you know, the five, I think it took them some time to feel comfortable opening up, but they all, I think, were really ready to tell their story. I think no one had really asked them before to tell their side of the story. It's like they'd been covered so much in the media, but no one had ever said, what do you think? How do you feel? What happened to you? How did this happen to you? And so I think having someone trying to give them this opportunity to tell the story was important to them.
I guess there was less media, and of course it was all pre-1,000 channels, internet, etc.
Yeah, in 89, New York City was in the midst of the tabloid wars, too. And so, you know, in the days after the incident, I think for 7 consecutive days, the 4 major dailies had headlines, sort of screaming boldface headlines that use unspeakable terms to describe these guys, really dehumanized them, never gave them a fair shake. I mean, by the time they got to a trial, everybody in the city knew about these guys. Many people in the country did. It was such a sensational story that captured so much attention. It got far less attention in 2002 when it was found out that they were actually innocent. And in some cases, the media actually, they were reluctant to report that their innocence. I mean, there were headlines that said things like, not so fast on the Jogger 5. But even in 2010 or 11, when Sarah published an opinion piece in the Post, the accompanying photographs, which were captioned by the Post, referred to the five as hoodlums. And so even now that we know the actual details and we know they're innocent and the district attorney's office has found them innocent, they joined in the motion in 2002 to vacate the convictions, the press is still using language to the same sort of language they used in 1989. So even in the age of 1,000 channels, the people sure. that were invested in that original outcome, some of that media that led to their convictions by painting them in a certain way in the press, are still holding fast to that original decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. You know, when we've talked to people about this case, most people know something about it. Oh, yeah, the Wilding case. Or, you know, that they remember that time in the city, but they don't know that the convictions were vacated. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they know, but they assume that it was some kind of legal loophole or technicality and not this clear evidence of someone DNA. Else's guilt and their innocence.
Right, and a confession and DNA. You can't get it anymore.
Right.
It's clearer than that.
But people don't know that part of the story.
Yeah, did the attorneys of the five, did they, you mentioned that they had some maybe ambivalence initially anyway. Did anybody anticipate what would then happen in terms of the city subpoenaing your footage?
I think the lawyers had suspected that that could happen and had warned us of that possibility. So it wasn't entirely shocking when it did happen. Still disappointing, but we had been aware of the fact that that could happen. And I think that that may have been part of the reason the lawyers were concerned about it, you know, as any lawyer trying to protect their client is concerned about how, what kind of media attention and press they're getting and how that could impact the case.
Mm-hmm. Now that the film is done, I know there's, you guys are, you've decided to with not comply to turning over the footage. You have a film, it's finished. The word is that, you know, is that it's being really well received. It's now in Doc NYC.
No, we started at the Cannes Film Festival back in May, and we've been at Toronto and Telluride and London, a number of other festivals overseas.
We've but when you get to the Chicago. Bigger ones, there might... No, I'm kidding. I just
Thanks for saying. And we're opening here in New York on November 23rd at the IFC Center at Lincoln Plaza at the Maisel Cinema in Harlem. And all the while, there's this conversation going on in the papers as the press is interested in this subpoena. And so that will continue to play out as well. That's another thread in all this. And then by mid-December, we'll have a wider release and be in a dozen other cities across the country.
Well, hopefully, the result will be in some percentage of the population being a little bit more privy to exactly what did unfold, and hopefully holding the media somewhat more accountable going forward.
Yeah, that's what we hope.
Well, thank you both very much for coming on Film Wax Radio, and I wish you a lot of luck with the film.
Thanks so much for having us.
Last night, a woman jogger was found unconscious and partially clothed in Central Park. She was beaten and sexually assaulted.
A woman jogging in Central Park. Central Park was holy. It was the crime of the century.
Five youths were arrested at 96th Street, all between 14 and 15 years of age.
They got them!
You can only imagine the pressure to have this crime solved and solved quickly.
First we was all together, then they started to put us in different rooms separately.
What did you do? Who were you with? Who did you come with?
The tone was very scary. I felt like they might take us to the back of the precinct and kill us.
You're not gonna go home until you give up a story.
I told my son, go to the park that night. I feel guilty.
I'm telling the guy, I don't know what you're talking about. They're getting a little angry.
And they're like, you know, you did it, didn't you?
Corey, thank you for coming on Film Wax Radio.
Pleasure being on Film Wax Radio with you.
So I have to ask you right away, were you familiar with Ken Burns?
No, my new lawyer introduced me to him and and his background.
Uh-huh. Have you had a chance, other than, of course, you know, Central Park 5,
right,
have you had a chance to look at any of the other films he's done?
No.
Not yet?
No, sir.
Okay. I grew up here in New York, too. I grew up in Queens, and I have very vivid memories in 1989 when all that happened. And like everybody else, I just bought what the media was telling me. I just assumed, you know, there was a lot of tension and fear in the city at the time. The media and the politicians weren't helping reduce that any. What do you make of the media now, and what do you make of how they report the story, or maybe even other stories now?
Yeah, I would say from then to now, is a lot has changed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot has changed, but the sad part of it is a lot being talked about, but none of this here talk is coming out. That's how much has changed.
So you mean about York, particularly about the Central Park,
right,
and what people think about the Central Park?
Huh?
And what people you think?
Well, that they think or what have you, just is not a topic.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Nobody's reporting it.
Right.
I see what you're saying. Right.
You hear so much.
This is maybe a question you can't answer in a short amount of time, so feel free not to answer it.
Okay.
But how do you begin to put behind you the bitter feelings and the rage that you have to have about what happened to you? Because you're one of those victims that, you know, in that whole experience. And I just wonder how you pick yourself up and move on. Is the lawsuit one way, or is
It's pending, but overall is what keeps me motivated is just really believing in myself. That's it.
Right.
Just believing in myself and my capabilities and what have you. Just believing in myself and just pushing myself into doing successful things.
That makes sense, because that's pretty much what everybody else has to do too. Right. And what is your relationship like now with the other four gentlemen?
As we all done got older, we all have our own individual life. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with a now, Central Park 5, it's what you call work. You got work to do.
You mean like talking about the film, representing the film and all that?
We have work to do. You know, although, you know, we all didn't know each other, but as of now, we have no choice but to know each other.
Right.
We have work to do for our children and our children's children. We got work to do.
It must be odd to have this connection through the for your whole lives now with these guys, and through no decision of your own.
Right.
What do you think of the movie?
It's beautiful. It gives us a voice.
Right.
Like I said, during the news, as of now for the 21st century, is a whole lot of talking about cases very similar to ours, to mine's, but we're not being spoken on. So my divine God brought us an angel, which is Sarah Burns and her husband Dave, along with the great Ken Burns. So we are very good now. I'm very happy.
Do you feel a sense of responsibility, in a sense of that, even though you went through such a such a tragic circumstance, though, that now maybe you can be a symbol for others? You know, whether young folks or other prisoners that have been wrongfully accused or even maybe rightfully accused.
I've been seen that way ever since I've been involved with the Byrne family.
And can you also kind of talk about what life might be like after the film kind of had its run and life continues?
It will be a brand new life. Because now what's missing is not missing now. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
Now is eyes on you.
Have you gone to many of the festivals with the film?
Yeah.
Yeah, did you go to France?
No.
Okay. So you've been traveling around a number of years, like Doc NYC, but in a few others.
Right.
And you must have been meeting a lot of people.
Yeah, I have.
Relationships.
I have.
Anything happen at, throughout some of these festivals or screenings stands out in particular?
Father, I'm sorry, you know, when experiencing this for the very first time in my life, seeing people in theaters, the most beautiful thing is for them to be there from the beginning to the middle to the end. Because they got places to go, people say things to do. So with all that, they gave it to us.
Their time.
Right. Mm-hmm. I feel appreciative for that. I would like to say thank them for that.
That's really generous. Has anybody come up to you and said that they were, you know, whether they're in the media or politics or a lawyer, and nobody's come up and nobody's apologized? Never?
No.
Never?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Anyway, listen, I really appreciate your talking to me. And
thank you.
And it's good to have heard your story firsthand. So thank you, Corey, for...
Thank you, man.
All right. Good meeting you.
A lot of people didn't do their jobs. Reporters, police, prosecutors, defense lawyers. This was institutional protectionist.
We falsely convicted them, and we walked away from our crime.
This is the ultimate siren that says none of us is safe.
Well, first of all, thank you for submitting to this the Hill Mike's radio interview. And you know, there's the Ken Burns effect. I don't know if I'm bringing this to your attention or not, that it exists, but how did you arrive at it, and would you have done anything differently?
What the Ken Burns effect is sort of the technological tail wagging the dog. Apple computers have had for the last 10 years a feature called the Ken Burns effect that slowly pans and zooms through the photographs that you can download, and it saved many a bar mitzvah and a wedding and a vacation story. What the Ken Burns effect for me has not been called the Ken Burns effect. It's essentially the authentic application of the techniques, the tools of my trade to tell a story. And because so many of the stories that I want to tell are in American history and rely on archives. It's how you wake up an old photograph, that is to say, how you energetically explore the surface landscape of an old still photograph with energetic camera eye, how you take an old photograph and understand that it had a past as well as a future in addition to its present arrested moment, how you listen to that photograph, how you hear the sounds that might be there, how you will it alive, how you treat it the way a feature filmmaker might as a master shot, including a long, a medium, a close, a tilt, a pan, a reveal, pulling out, and the insert of certain details, adding to that period music, complicated sound effects track, and not just a third-person voice of God narrator, but first-person voices reading stuff that give a sense of the past a verisimilitude. There's a great arrogance we in the present impose on the past, that we think that by virtue of the fact we survive, we're somehow better. But people who've lived hundreds of years ago live just as full of lives as we did, and it is my job to try to honor that, particularly in my case, by choosing American history. So in that aggregate is how a filmmaker responds. So if you look at a distance without careful study, all of the films seem exactly the same, filled with the quote, Ken Burns effect, unquote. But in fact, as any artist tries to do, if you authentically employ these techniques, you develop what is a style, and that each film is this different calibration of all the elements, all the techniques that go into doing that. And that's an important thing to understand and distinguish. And if people would rather not see the films or look at them carefully, and rather talk about them because they think they know what's in them, then they've missed it, and it's possible to abbreviate the Ken Burns effect. We don't call it the Ken Burns effect inside this brain, nor do we call it that in the editing room. We call it working hard.
It was shorthand from my perspective, so forgive me. Do you find it that it is reductive then to refer to what you're doing?
No, I don't find it. I mean, certainly in some cases it's reductive because people are using it either in a sort of passively aggressive pejorative sense. But most people, it's a sincere thing. I love your films. I can always tell when it's your film. And I'll say to my wife, you know, I think this is a Ken Burns film. And we'll watch it and it was great. And at the end it said, a film by Ken Burns, and I said, see, I told you. And the fact that these are watched by tens of millions of people, 45 million people watch baseball just the first time it was broadcast, 40 million for the Civil War just the first time, that's an awful lot of people to reach and try to have a conversation with, and that's what I'm most concerned about, is how to reach the most number of people with complicated stories in American history that are unafraid of controversy and tragedy, but equally drawn to those stories and moments that suggest an abiding faith in the human spirit, and particularly the unique role this remarkable but also sometimes hugely dysfunctional republic seems to play in the positive progress of mankind. That's what I do.
Well said. Archiving is another big topic, of course. What could you possibly offer to a filmmaker who is grappling with also history, maybe a lot of images?
I don't offer specific filmic advice because each person has to find their own way. My mother died when I was 11 years old. She had been sick with cancer for almost 10 years. There wasn't a moment, therefore, in my life when I wasn't aware of her imminent death. After she died, my father had a fairly tough curfew for my younger brother and me, but he forgave it. If there was a movie on TV that allowed me to stay up late at night with god-awful commercials to watch, he took me out to the Cinema Guild, and I saw French New Wave films and old American classics, including silent films by Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, and also great seminal work like Orson Welles. I watched my father cry for the first time looking at these films, and I realized then and there, at age 12, that I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I've wanted to be a filmmaker ever since, because I realize there's a potential to unlock things. Now, what I do in my professional life and have done for several decades is sort of try to will the past alive and, in essence, wake the dead. One could relate it back to the early childhood trauma and wonder who I might be waking up. Mm-hmm. So I would only suggest that people bring their whole hearts to their activities and to try to remember, if you're using archives, that is as close a representation we will get to a reality as full as the reality you are living. If you respect that, you have the possibility to use it to the best abilities, to its best abilities, to its potential, and wake the dead.
I've heard you say that essentially this film is a continuation of the stories you've been telling for the majority of your films, that of race in this country.
Yeah, I don't think we go looking for race. I just think that if you're dealing with topics in American history, when you scratch the surface, as we try to do in public broadcasting, and not just be kind of superficial History Channel type stuff, you hit race. It's the ultimate, you know, original sin of this country. We're founded on the great sentence that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." But the guy who wrote it owned more than 100 human beings and didn't see the contradiction or the hypocrisy, and more importantly, never saw fit in his lifetime to free any of those individuals. So the American narrative is constantly grappling with the question of race. So you bump into it basically wherever you go. You bump into it in the Civil War, of course, and biographies of Thomas Jefferson, of course, in baseball when Jackie Robinson finally integrates the thing, in jazz, which was born in the African-American community, which was a community that had the peculiar experience of being unfree in a free land, and so many other topics that we've taken, and it's very much present in the Central Park Five. What the Central Park Five permits us to do is sort of liberate ourselves from traditional narrative devices. There's no narrator in this film. It's much more of a journalistic piece. It has, at least at periods, an incredibly different kind of pace and rhythm, deliberate on our part to the time and the music of the period. It has the same jitter of the anxious 80s and of the new music that was born called hip-hop. So that is part of it. But there are portions of it that remind me of all the other things that we've done. Not necessarily overtly stylistically, but just in this relentless pursuit of the questions of justice, of American identity, of race, of all the things that this very complicated story, you know, calls to mind.
Did you learn something new?
Well, I don't know if it's learn anything new. I learn something new every single day I'm working on a film, and if I wasn't, I'd stop making films, and this film was no exception. It was incredibly exhilarating because I had a chance to work with my daughter, who I'm so extraordinarily proud of and is so extraordinarily talented, and her husband, the great filmmaker David McMahon, who I've had the great pleasure of working with for many, many years. And this collaboration is in every sense an equal collaboration. And we made the film together, and it evolved out of work that Sarah had done. But this film is our film, and we're I'm passionate about explaining to the world that this isn't just a Ken Burns film. This is a collaboration, just as many of the films I've made are mine and Lynn Novick's, a longtime collaborator. I think that when you explore things that aren't within the normal stylistic realm that we've done, the kind of absence of narration, the periodic fast pacing, it does, you learn things. And I'm not going to tell you that the next film has got all of that. It's just each film adds to who you are. And if you're a good filmmaker, you're required to grow each time. The implication in a lot of these questions is, are you going to stop making those boring historical things? And what I first of all reject is that they're A, boring, and B, that there's anything wrong with historical.
Yeah.
That in fact, I've been led out of Montgomery, Alabama churches by state troopers who were afraid for my life because people didn't like the way my film on the Civil War turned out, and they were willing to kill the messenger. That there's nothing sort of safe about history, that by dealing with race, I've invited horrific amounts of hate mail based on what seems to people as an overt sensitivity and sympathy.
An attack on what they believe.
Attack on what they believe. So I'm not sure the history is sort of the safe province that many people sort of grappling with contemporary issues are. In fact, sometimes there's a myopia that comes from contemporary issues, and you need the perspective and the triangulation that can take place through the passage of time. Journalism, as it was famously pointed out, is the first rough draft of history, to which I'd like to point out, nobody ever turns in a rough draft.
How does the collaboration extend to the five?
Well, I think that in the making of the film, they submitted to interviews with Sarah and Dave, and I did most of the other interviews, and that was their contribution. I wouldn't call it a collaboration in any way. We're filmmakers, they are not. We made our film. When it was done, we shared it with them, and the collaboration began then, because a film is not just its conception, it's not just its doing or its execution, but it's in fact what happens after it takes on a life of its own. And to be able to go out into the world to attend the festivals at Cannes, at Telluride, at Toronto, at Mill Valley, at AFI, at London, at all of these places where the film has appeared, and in many of those venues be able to be accompanied by several of the Central Park Five has been one of the great privileges of my life, to hear them articulate and re-articulate things that are not only in the film, but to add dimension to the audience's outrage and questions that inevitably arise after dealing with such a horrible tragedy.
Ken Burns, thank you very much.
My